they start to understand their life in a way that they just didn't understand before because they've reviewed it. They've had a chance to look back with hindsight on some good times, but also the tough times and how they got through it. But also their children and grandchildren, when they read it, come to understand their parent or grandparent a lot better. I had a granddaughter who was one of our clients say, "I never understood why my grandmother acted the way she did until I read her memoir." When she read the book that we helped her produce, she said, "I finally understand why she's the way she is. And now I understand why I am the way I am, because she raised me."
What's going on, everybody? How's it going? Thanks so much for joining me on the Austin Meyer podcast once again, where we're talking storytelling. Things in my world are going well. I am recording today in my hometown of Santa Rosa, California, where we've had a lot of rain, and it's making everything very pretty and green and making my trail runs very fun and muddy. Also had an exciting publication this week, which is my latest short documentary came out with National Geographic in their short film showcase. So that story is called Musa and the Zambian Handball Dream. And it was a super fun one to make. I actually filmed it back in February of 2018, and it's been done for months, but Nat Geo held onto it for quite a while before publication. So it's very exciting to see it in the real world. If you haven't checked it out, it'd mean a lot to me if you did, and let me know what you think. I will put a link to the video in the show notes. And I also posted on all my social media channels at Austin Meyer Films, or you can just type in Zambia handball on Google and it should come up. Okay, let's get on to today's guest. And when I say guest, I actually mean today guests, plural guests. Yes, this is the first two-person interview of the Austin Meyer podcast, which is very exciting. This week's guests are Susan Milstein and Andy Brady. So Susan and Andy are co-founders of a company called Personal History Productions. And what this company does is super fascinating. This is a little excerpt from their website that sums up what they're all about. Quote, "Do you have a parent or grandparent whose life story you'd like to record? Perhaps you've dreamed of writing your own life story, but didn't know how to begin. Many of us would like to record our life stories and family memories as a legacy for future generations, but doing it yourself can be daunting. We make it easy for you." End quote. So what they do is help people leave a legacy through story, through telling their life stories. From the interviewing to the writing to creating a final book, Susan and Andy help individuals and families capture their stories as a memorial for future generations. In this conversation, Susan, Andy, and I talk about how this business idea came about, the step-by-step process of creating a personal history, and how telling the story of your life allows you to come to terms with and make meaning of your life narrative. So I hope you enjoy my conversation with Susan and Andy. Thank you so much, Susan and Andy, for joining the Austin Meyer podcast. So I'd love to start today's interview with whoever wants to answer this question. But when someone asks you, what do you do? What do you tell them? They're swiveling the mic here.
We tell people that we help individuals and companies and organizations record their stories. The individuals, it's for their families and for future generations of their families and friends. And the companies and organizations, it's for their employees, their investors, their customers, anyone who might be interested in understanding the history of the company or organization and okay. The public.
Okay. So can you tell me the journey of how you arrived at starting this as a company?
Susan and I had different paths to get here. She was a journalist. She worked at a magazine and different newspapers, including The Chronicle and the big paper in Atlanta and Houston?
Atlanta and Dallas.
And I got a master's degree in English and started working for small publishing companies, which I really loved. And then I started working for Random House. And at a certain point in the early 90s, the big five publishing houses started acquiring lots of smaller publishing companies and making them their imprint. I worked for one of those small companies that was acquired. So I then began working for Random House, and I've always had a home-based office. So that's worked out well for me. And then what happens when things expand? Things contract. And so Random House had too many imprints or some imprints with overlap in their backlist of books. And so I saw the writing on the wall, and sure enough, our imprint was closed down. That worked. The timing was pretty good for me because I had three small children at the time. And so I thought, oh, I'll try not working for a while, but I really missed it. And then Susan and I had known each other for a while, and we were just talking one day and decided, how did it go exactly?
How'd the conversation go?
I think I had done a memoir for a woman I knew who was in her 90s, and she had come to me and said, my daughter gave me this tape recorder and told me just to tell my story into it, and I just can't do it. And she was a friend of mine. I knew her through my synagogue. And I knew she'd had an interesting life, and I was kind of just couldn't resist. I said, well, how about I just come over and I just interview you, and it'll make it fun, and it will go really well. So I did. And she did have a wonderful story, and I typed it up, but I didn't have any of the production skills. I had the interviewing skills and the writing skills,
right.
But I didn't know what to do with it beyond a Word document. And I showed it to Andy, and she said to me, this is when she was still working for the imprint of Random House, you could really turn this into a beautiful book that would be an heirloom that they could pass on through the family. Mm-hmm. I said, well, I have no idea how to do that. And she said, well, you should look for someone to go into business with and turn this into a business. And then after her job ended, she said to me, how about we go into business together? And I said, that would be great. So she said, I'll handle all the production part, and you can handle most of the marketing and the interviewing and the writing, and I'll take it from there. I'll do the editing, and then together we'll talk to the client about what kind of book they want. We'll design it and create a beautiful book that can be handed down in the family.
For that example with your friend when she was telling her life story and the daughter gave the friend a tape recorder, do you have any sense of why the daughter, like, that's an interesting decision from her end to give her mother? Was it a mother?
Her mother.
Yeah,
right.
A tape recorder. Where did that come from the daughter?
I think that a lot of people are curious about their parents' stories, but they're uncomfortable sitting down and interviewing them, and they're bringing a lot of emotional baggage to the encounter. And for one reason or another, a lot of people aren't comfortable interviewing their parents about their lives, and a lot of parents aren't comfortable sitting down and revealing their struggles and their challenges and with their children.
Yeah, what happens is you find that the relationship kind of inhibits the person who is being interviewed. Because if it's your mother or your father, you're never going to get out of that outside of that relationship. It's very hard to do. And so it causes the person being interviewed to be inhibited in a way that they aren't with an outsider or professional.
Interesting.
Some of the honesty, I think, is lost in the interview process because of the roles that have been established between the parent and the child or the grandparent and the grandchild. The people who are being interviewed, they answer in ways that they think that they're supposed to.
Right.
Which isn't maybe the most honest or interesting or helpful way.
Yeah, I can totally see that kind of baggage coming into an interview.
Exactly.
You're speaking to someone, even if you have a really, great relationship with a parent.
Right. But I did have to put that aside because our first big job, we did make a book of the woman who I had interviewed from her story. But then we wanted to do more prototypes. So my parents were living on the East Coast, and I was living here in California. So I had them come out for a week And for every day for 5 days, I would bring my father upstairs for 2 hours, sit him in a chair, and I put on my reporter hat. I wasn't his daughter. I was a reporter. Hmm. And I interviewed him about his life. Then he'd go downstairs. I'd bring my mother up. So for a week, I interviewed my parents every day. And then I created books about their lives. Hmm. And I really did have to really pull myself into out of the daughter role and into the journalist role, and not comment or not say, but wait a minute, that's not how I remember it, you know, and things like that.
Yeah. So, did you have to tell them like it's okay? Did you have to kind of open up space for them to be completely honest and not view you as their daughter in that setting?
I don't remember exactly how I set it up, but mm-hmm. maybe just from my behavior.
Right.
Because when I'm doing these interviews, they're really not conversations. Even if somebody says something that reminds me of something in my life, I never, ever bring it up. Everything is always directed at helping the person recall their perceptions of what happened in their life. Hmm. And even if they tell me something and I think, oh, wait a minute, that's exactly where my father grew up, I wouldn't say it.
Yeah.
So.
And what was that experience like for you telling the story of your parents?
Well, what was interesting is that I realized that I came to understand my parents in a much more deep way than I ever had before, and saw them in different stages of their lives that I hadn't really thought about, because I don't think people really think about their parents like that when they're growing up, and even when they get to be older, they may not think about them as three-dimensional people at each stage of their life.
Hmm.
Oftentimes in our business, our clients are concerned that who they view as their audience, which is generally their children and grandchildren, may not end up being the audience, the actual audience. Because for some strange reason, most children aren't really interested in seeing their parents in a way outside of the parent-child relationship. So sometimes it's a surprise audience and it ends up being the great-grandchildren. Mm. So that's not unusual.
So are the people who usually come to you and want to hire you, are they the people who want to tell their own story? Are they the siblings or children of someone whose story they want to be told? Who are the usual clients?
We usually have two types of clients. It's either the adult children who want to record their parents' or grandparents' stories before it's too late.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes our clients are the people themselves who want to record their history as a legacy for their children, grandchildren, and future generations of the family. So it goes both ways.
Hmm. Yeah. That's interesting.
Some of our clients are people who have tried to write their own stories, and some of them have just found it way too daunting. They just don't know how to start. They get frustrated, and other people have written them. We have one client who had written his entire book on yellow legal pads and just came to us, but he just didn't know what to do with it. And so we helped him, first of all, get it into a digital document and then edit it and create. And then at that point, after he was happy with the manuscript, then gather his photos and talk to him about design and then create a beautiful designed book that he was proud of.
Austin, one thing I wanted to talk to you about that I thought would be kind of interesting is we do hard copy archival books.
Yeah.
And you are a digital specialist.
Yes.
So do you want to ask us why we're doing books instead of
I think that's a great
films?
Question. Yeah. Why is it?
Well, I like to... films are great.
Yeah.
And there's nothing that can replace footage of your parents or your grandparents moving through a space, because people move the same way they always move. You can identify someone from 100 feet, you know, even if you can't see their face, just by the way they move.
Mm-hmm.
And so video was great. But think of how much technology has changed in 10 or 20 years.
Yeah.
And in we really do think of our product as legacy product. And in 50 years, most families will still probably have a bookshelf.
It's true.
And so it will be very easy to walk over and pull that book down, open it up, and hear the voice of the person who's gone, the person who you love.
Yeah.
With video, there are so many barriers to actually getting to the point where you sit down and watch it, that's one of the reasons. Plus books, we're both bibliophiles, and holding a beautiful book in your hand.
Yeah.
Just the tangible, what's the word I want? The physical
kinesthetic,
act,
maybe?
Yes, of holding the book is a wonderful thing.
Yeah.
So that is why.
Yeah, that's interesting. I was mentioning to Susan on the phone when we first chatted that, so one, I recently did a short film and submitted it to this film competition, which was themed around remembering a life. It was put on by the National Funeral Directors Association. And mine was one of three films that was chosen as winners. And us three filmmakers got to go to Salt Lake City to the National Funeral Directors, like, International Expo. And we...
Did you wear black?
Probably. And so we showed our films, and the reason that they did put on this film competition is they were trying to get funeral directors to start thinking about memorializing people in new ways, in different ways. And as part of that convention, we also were a part of this storytelling workshop, and lots of the funeral directors were asking us about the, like, technical aspects of making a film to memorialize someone. And it was in those conversations that I really realized that, like, film can be a really powerful way to honor someone's legacy in the ways that you get to actually hear their voice and to see them. But the barriers to making films are pretty challenging. If you want something has some sort of production value. I mean, our phones can do it, but, you know, my film, you know, I sat down with someone for over an hour and the final product is 5 minutes. Whereas at a book, I think you have a little bit more leeway to expand on those life experiences. Is that true?
Yes. I mean, typically I'll be interviewing someone for a minimum of 6 hours, and I've interviewed people for 15 to 20 hours. Then once I have the interview done, it's transcribed verbatim, and then I take that transcript and shape it into a readable, flowing narrative. So I'm moving sentences around, I'm editing the sentences, I'm tweaking them. Sometimes I'm even having to ghostwrite sentences because they just didn't come out of the person's mouth the way someone would read it.
Mm-hmm.
Then they get a chance to review that draft, and some people will just put a few little corrections on. Other people, for example, we had a young client who was in her 40s, and she was a young mother, and she was dying. She actually died at age 40, so she was in her 30s. She took the digital document, the original draft, and just put it in her computer and used it as a jumping off point to really get exactly what she wanted to say down. But she couldn't have done it from nothing. I mean, it would have been way too hard. But the process of the long interviews and the drafts gives people a chance to really fine-tune what they want to say and the legacy they want to lead. Whereas if you're being interviewed and then someone's going to take that and edit it, well, you know, it doesn't give you maybe the chance to really fine-tune exactly what you want to say.
Yeah, yeah.
Austin, you were saying that when you did a film, you would film for an hour and then end up with a 3 or 5 minute product.
Yeah.
It's not that different from our professionally done books. For every hour of client interview, probably 20 to 25 hours go into each backroom work, goes into each hour that Susan is interviewing someone.
Okay. Yeah. So pretty comparable.
Yeah.
But the process is a longer process,
right.
And there's an opportunity to fine tune it in a way that you just can't do with video. I mean, it's just not the same.
So yeah, I'd love to get into the specifics of your process. So you said 6 to 15, or sometimes even more, of interviewing.
Right.
And when you go into that interview, walk me through everything from, like, where do you do these interviews to get what? To get the types of stories that you're hoping to get from clients.
Right.
And where do you even start?
Well, first we give the narrator, whoever the narrator, sometimes the narrators are clients, sometimes the client is the adult child. So the narrator is the person who's going to be we're going to be interviewing, we give them a form to fill out that gives us the parameters of their lives that I know. So when I walk in, I may have already gotten their document and I've already talked to them on the phone about how many siblings, where they grew up, how many siblings they had, and how many times, when they got married, were they in the military, things like that. So I really know the outline of their lives. And I already know some of the challenges they've had to go through in their lives. So I sort of know, but we don't go into detail beforehand. Mm-hmm. And then when I go to their, usually I interview them at their home, unless there's some reason why they can't be interviewed there. I always insist on being alone. So if they have a spouse, we arrange for that spouse to leave the house.
Yeah.
And so I'm just alone with them. They're sitting in the most comfortable chair that they have in their house for them. And I just work around them. Because usually the audio quality doesn't have to be top-notch if I'm doing a book. Mm-hmm. So it's okay, you know, if it's just as long as I can transcribe it. And then at that point, when I first go in, I start out with really open-ended questions. Like, just tell me the story of where you were born, who was in your family, and what was going on with your family at that time. And then just lead them through their life chronologically. That's not usually the way the book is written, but it helps them. And really what I'm focusing on in each chapter that I'm interviewing them about is what were the relationships, experiences, and events that touched them the most, had the biggest impact, shaped them. From their perspective, and really, it is just their perception because, you know, there is no reality. We don't really know what one person says happened. Another person who was in the room at the same time has a totally different perception. So I tell them, don't worry, just tell me what you remember as you perceive it, and it becomes this kind of just really open-ended interview where I don't really. Discuss. I just keep asking, tell me more, tell me mm-hmm. more. Is there anything else you remember about that?
Yeah.
You know?
Hmm.
And we proceed that way through the interview.
So relationships, experiences, and events, and you kind of guide the conversation around those. Do you find that those are usually the ones that they start talking to you about? Do you have to mine for specifics or small moments? Because I find that, like, when I'm doing interviews, a lot of times the best little stories that someone will give me are never ones that they would have, like, told around a dinner table or, like, these big moments sometimes that they think about as foundational in their life. They're these little moments that come out after a lot of conversation.
Right. Well, I think by not engaging in a conversation and just giving them space to really think back, and if they start talking about a particular experience that was either life-changing or just it just really is in their minds, maybe it was just something funny that happened, by me not going back and forth with them, it gives them the space to just recollect and just start telling me stories. And I might say, tell me more about that, or do you remember what she said, or do you remember where you were? So I will ask questions like that if that's what you're talking about. A lot of times people are talking about life-changing events, like escaping from a country in the middle of the night and walking with their mother through the snow and things like that. But other times they're telling really funny little stories. I mean, I'll read just one that,
yeah,
that we always talk about because it's one of our favorite stories. And it's just a little tiny story, but it's...
And we have clients... approval to read
permission.
This.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So this man was talking about his mother, mm-hmm. and his mother had been a nurse in World War I, but he was born, of course, after that. And he was telling this story, and the little story is called The Cure for Everything. My mother never went back to nursing after the war, strangely enough, but she was certainly a nurse at home. Her nursing background made her very caring and mindful of my health. I was a pretty healthy kid, but my mom could make mountains out of molehills. She could just look at me and diagnose me with having acidosis. Well, there's no such thing as acidosis, but she believed there was. And if anything was at all was wrong with you, she would turn you over her knee and give you an enema. She thought enemas cured everything. I can't tell you how many times she put me over her knee. That was standard procedure. Years later, when I was in high school and we lived out on Sonoma Highway, my dad hired a guy to mow the weeds on our property. One day he got off the mower, knocked at the door, and said, "Mrs. Smith, I just don't feel well. I'm going to have to leave for the day." She said, "You come on in here. We'll fix you up in no time." She thought it was the cure for everything. So I just thought that was just like a great little story.
Amazing.
And he just, you know, was telling me about his, I just asked him about, "Tell me about your mom." And this is the kind of stories that come out. So,
Oh, that's so nice.
Austin, in answer to your question about the little story, sometimes we don't get the details that you were referring to until we're in the copy editing process.
Okay.
And part of the process is if we feel like we need more detail or more depth or more vividness in a particular section, then we'll ask. And then sometimes we get the really great stuff
okay.
at that point.
Okay.
Right. That is another advantage of, yeah. of the books, is that once we get the draft written, we can see where the holes are.
Yeah.
And we can go back and either interview the person, or sometimes they can just fill it in.
So when you're doing those first interviews, are you listening to the answers with like thinking in the future of kind of like a final book coming together?
Always.
Like, what do I need? Or you kind of just like throw everything at me? Or do you have to come in with some sort of...
Well, in these books, the books that are done for families... Mm-hmm. It unlike a book that would be done for the general public, the more the better, because you never know what someone in the family is going to be interested in, some grandchild or whatever. But I am always thinking about, they're telling me a story. What else do I need from the... And often sometimes that kind of helps me, because sometimes they're telling me very painful stories. I mean, I've interviewed people who've been in concentration camps or people who have had terrible accidents or diseases or had to escape for their lives or, you know, who are dying while I'm interviewing them. Mm-hmm. And it really doesn't affect me when I'm interviewing them, because the whole time I'm thinking, am I getting what I need? Am I getting what I need? Is there something else I should be asking them? Is this a story that I need to ask them more about?
Yeah.
It's not unusual, though, for Susan, when she's finished with the interviewing process, because we've been doing this so long, she will have the structure worked out already.
Wow.
Just from listening for 10 to 15 hours, she'll hear that story, and she can visualize from that. We're going to open the book with that, and then it's going to flow this way.
Hmm. Using that experience.
Right, because usually we don't open the book with, you know, I was born in, you know, we tried to look for a pivotal event in the person's life, or some kind of emblematic event or story.
Yeah, an exciting story.
And open it with that, and then back into the way, you know, most memoirs that you would read are written.
So what percentage of the books are just for family versus ones where people are like, yeah, why don't we just self-publish it and see who is interested?
We decided long ago that we were going to specialize in non-commercial print products.
Okay.
And so you're familiar with an ISBN. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of like a social security number for a book, and all books need it to be sold commercially.
Yeah.
Many of our books don't even have an ISBN because they're privately published. And we will have a certain number of units printed. Okay. And it's not a print-on-demand situation. Occasionally, we'll have clients who want to do that, but we try and be realistic with them.
Mm-hmm.
The chances are not good that they're going to produce a bestseller.
Yeah.
Needle in a haystack kind of thing. And so we try and set their expectations, but sometimes they want to. And in those cases, we generally just use one of a few print-on-demand companies.
Hmm.
Also, we do sometimes have them available. So, you know, they can say, sometimes they want to hand out copies, but then other people want, you know, they don't want to hand out like 700 copies. So
yeah.
We have had people who order 300, 400 copies, though, to hand out. And then they'll say, you know, beyond that, we'll just put it on Amazon. And if someone wants a copy, then they have to order it. So
earlier we were saying how, you know, if a family member was interviewing their own family member, they might get some cagey responses. They might not get the whole honest truth. So, Susan, you go in and do the interview. I'm wondering how you would describe kind of like the quality of stories and honesty that they give you, knowing that this book is like specifically for my family to read. It's not commercially available.
Right.
So, well, are they super honest because of that, or?
Well, obviously there's a range. Yeah. Some people are guarded throughout the entire interview and they're just never let down their guard. But I'd say for the most part, after certainly the first couple of interviews with them, they come to trust me and they start to enjoy just opening up, and they'll tell me things and they'll say, this can't go in the book. This can never go in the book. Or sometimes they'll say, well, yeah, I understand that this can't go in the book, but maybe there's a way we can hint at it, because this was really a huge thing in your life and it did influence you and shape you. So maybe there's a way we can word it. Mm. So I'll work with them. I mean, this is a kind of a funny thing, but one of our clients, I said to him, he told me he had been dating the woman he ended up marrying. I said, well, how did you decide to marry Peggy? When did you decide to marry her? He said, well, she got pregnant, but we can't put that in the book. So I said, oh, don't worry, we'll word it carefully. So in the final version, it said, after Peggy and I had been dating for a while, I decided she was the kind of woman I wanted to have a family with.
Nice.
And another man, we were trying to talk about the section where he was talking about his grandchildren, and he was telling about this grandchild and that grandchild, and there was one grandchild who had married someone he really disliked. And I said, you didn't say anything about Tom. We have to talk about Tom. He said, I don't like Tom. And I said, well, you can't leave him out. We have to say something about him. So I start to brainstorm with him. Well, he's a hard worker, isn't he? And yeah, he is. And after a while, he said, I'm starting to like him more.
While we want to be honest with our books, and we encourage our clients to be honest when they're telling the stories, because of the purpose of our books, mm-hmm. and I don't know if it's different, Austin, for what you do, but in the editing process, sometimes we'll go back and we will query the client, is this going to hurt someone's feelings? Mm-hmm. Because while we want to be honest, oftentimes our books are going to be read by someone when the client has passed away.
Right.
And so we are always very careful to be honest, but also sensitive mm-hmm. to the way we phrase things, mm-hmm. especially because our product deals with family, legacy for the family. So we're very careful. We keep that in mind as we edit.
Yeah. Yeah. And I would say for me, it's definitely a huge consideration that I'm always thinking about, especially people's personal safety. And making sure that the way I'm telling a story doesn't cross cultural norms and traditions, when I'm working, especially in different countries. I think from, working as a video journalist, the other side of it is that sometimes you got to just be okay with people not liking what you put out there.
Exactly. We had, this is pretty typical. We had a client, she was in her 90s, and she sent her book when it was done to her older sister, who was even more advanced in her 90s. And the sister read it and called her. The sister doesn't even live in the United States, and said, you got it all wrong, our whole family story wrong. Well, the answer is, you can write your own book, because everybody has a different story to tell. She told her perception of what was going on mm-hmm. in the family from her perspective. Someone else is going to have a different story.
Yeah.
And Austin, one thing that we do that I'm sure that you do, you were talking about different cultures. Mm-hmm. I'm sure before you go into a country like Zambia, you do your background reading, you read history books, mm-hmm. you read cultural books, and we do the same thing. If we know that our client was in World War II in the Pacific Theater or in a different theater, then we'll do background research. And both of us, not Susan, but me too, we'll read 2, 3, 4 books so that we're conversant with that person's life and the historical time that they were going through. We've had clients from Indonesia. We've had clients India. And so we make sure that we at least have the lay of the land.
Yeah, makes sense. Yeah. So going through back through the process, just so I make sure yes. I kind of understand how the whole things come together. So you do the interviews, then you transcribe everything. Are you using a transcription service or you're sitting there with the headphones and
sometimes
the keyboard?
I transcribe it myself. Sometimes we use a transcriptionist and sometimes we use transcription services.
Okay.
That then I have to go through very carefully because, you know, the automated transcription services are not, a lot of mistakes.
Yes.
But, you know, one way or another, we get it transcribed and then create the draft,
okay.
which takes the most time.
Okay.
Because even though they tell me I'm interviewing them, it's never coming out of their mouth in the way that I need to use it for a written, flowing narrative manuscript. So I'm having to massage essentially every single sentence that goes in the book. Nothing really goes without me massaging it a little bit, if not almost rewriting it.
So how do you start to put together the structure? I'm going through this right now with the documentary.
Yeah.
You know, I'm trying to figure out, I have all this material. How do I even start to like break things into different sections and themes and structure it? So I'm really interested to hear that.
Right. So I do come up with a basic structure. I usually start to figure out what story or scene I want to open up with. And then I know that at some point I'm going to go back into, after I tell this opening story, I'm going to somehow connect that to their background, to their birth family and where they were born. At some point, I'm going to go into the story chronologically.
Mm.
So it's really just, and then most of our manuscripts do follow a chronological order, although there are times where they're talking about personal life and then career, and so they have to go back and forth, and that doesn't necessarily track exactly chronologically, so I couldn't just do it year by year or anything like that. So you just have to keep just thinking of how it's going to work what the material I've got. And then what I do is once I create the structure and I have subheads, because we usually use chapters and subheads, I'll start to move the transcription, the blocks of transcription, just kind of place them where I think they're going to go, and then go in and write each section. And sometimes that gets moved around. It's a very time consuming.
Yeah.
I'm sure it's for you. And at that point, then they get the draft. And they can, as I said, edit it heavily, rewrite the entire thing if they want, or just sometimes they give it back to us with just a few marks on it. It just really depends on where they're at and what they want to do with it.
Yeah.
Once we have it at that point, we have a manuscript. That's when Andy really, when her part, because for our books, the words are important, but the design also reflects the message they want to send and their legacy. So I'll let Andy kind of explain how we approach what kind of design we want for the book.
For your audience, I don't know that it's important for me to get into what I do with editorial and production, but I will say that for us, it's pretty divided. Susan does the interviewing and most of the writing, although sometimes I'll do the writing. And then I do the editorial and the production, but sometimes she'll take over production tasks.
Yeah. So. Well, I even think like I'd love to hear about the production process and just how you think about, you know, the way a book feels, the way a book looks. The whole presentation of it is part of the story.
Meeting the client is really important. It's difficult when we're working with long distance clients, which we often do, because it's helpful to meet the client. To see how that person dresses. How does that person move? Are they elegant? Are they casual? Do they have a sense of humor? Are they serious? What's important to them? And then I do a mini interview about what they envision for their final product. But sometimes they'll say things that don't jive with what I see. And then in the design process, we do preliminary designs and we'll show them different versions and then we have a conversation.
When Andy says preliminary designs, it's covers. So usually about three different covers that we come up with after she's talked to them and gets a feel for what kind of book they think they want. Sometimes they'll take out a book and they'll say, I like this book. I want it to look like this. But other times they just give us these words that, you know, I like...
bright blue.
Yeah, bright blue, or I like the classic look. And so we have to intuit what's going to make them happy. So usually Andy will come back with three cover designs and three interior page looks, you know, layouts, so they can look at the font, the layout, the design, and the way pictures are handled.
Yeah.
And then they get to choose.
For your audience, again, I don't know how important that is, but photos are very important, as they are for your work.
Mm-hmm.
And so Susan, will going back to an earlier point in our conversation where you were talking about what does Susan do before she goes in and meets the client for the first time, sometimes if the client is reticent or feeling unsure, or they're doing it because their adult child is inviting them to tell their story, we'll have them pull out old pictures and start the process of culling what pictures they want to go in the book early, because the pictures will spark the memories. And that can be a really good source of detail.
Right. Photos are crucial to our projects. I think that when we give people the books, their children and grandchildren, the first thing they do is not read the story, but flip through, look at the photos, look at any captions we have, any sidebars, anything like that first.
Yeah.
And then they may read this and read that, but the photos are crucial. So most of our books, we try to encourage people to place as many photos as they can afford to place, because that does drive up the cost.
I was reading the article that you sent me before our interview. Zinsler, was it?
Zinsser.
Mm-hmm. Zinsser article.
For
our listening audience.
It's called How to Write a Memoir by William Zinsser in 2015.
And there was a sentence I'd like to read and would like to structure some of our conversation around it. And it's about the purpose of doing this and what this offers somebody who's sharing their story personally, but then also what it provides for that family who's then reading the legacy. So the quote is, "Writing is a powerful search mechanism, and one of its satisfactions is that it allows you to come to terms with your life narrative. It also allows you to work through some of life's hardest knocks, life or loss, grief, illness, addiction, disappointment, failure, and to find understanding and solace." And I'd love to hear kind of you respond to that and how you've seen that with the people whose stories you've worked with telling.
Susan and I think about memory a lot, and we read a lot of nonfiction neuroscience books about memory because we're interested in this. Our clients, interestingly to me, almost never bring this up, but it's constantly on my mind. When you tell your story, you're bringing meaning to something that at the time it happened maybe didn't have that same meaning, but you're imposing meaning on it from a distance. I think that's one of the deeper reasons for writing a personal history or a memoir, is that it does allow you to impose meaning on your life and come to terms with some of the hard knocks that have happened to you. And our clients have sometimes told Susan after the interview process that they get something out of it that they did not intend.
Hmm.
You want to talk about that?
Yeah, I think that they do find that their life, they start to understand their life in a way that they just didn't understand before because they've reviewed it. They've had a chance to look back with hindsight on some good times, but also the tough times and how they got through it. But also their children and grandchildren, when they read it, first of all, come to understand their parent or grandparent a lot better. I had a granddaughter who was one of our clients say, "I never understood why my grandmother acted the way she did until I read her memoir." When she read the book that we helped her produce, she said, "I finally understand why she's the way she is. And now I understand why I am the way I am, because she raised me." And it gives me such great and insight into not just her life, but into my own life. We had another woman who had been a Holocaust survivor. Actually, she had left Germany right as Hitler was taking over with her husband and come here. And she didn't want her son to know that she was doing her book. She hired us. She did it. And he came to visit her. He was living in Berkeley, but he came here to visit her. And she gave it to him. And he left. And 2 hours later, he called. And she said, "Are you back in Berkeley?" He said, "No, I'm sitting on the curb outside your house. I'm just blown away. I just can't believe it." He finished the book. And
wow.
He was just understood his mother in a way that he just never had before, because the kinds of revelations that come out in a memoir like this, in a personal history, are just not the kinds of stories and revelations that come out over dinner. It's not the kind of thing that comes through a conversation. It only comes through deep review of your life.
And when people are sharing their story with you, and are in that moment, are they creating meaning around those experiences?
Yes.
Or is it not until that those experiences are kind of tied together with the transitions that you put in, or the order that you put them in, that they begin to see it?
Well, sometimes during the interview, I'll say things like, well, what were your other options? And they'll say, you know, I really didn't have another option. I was forced to do this because of this, this, and this. And so you can see that they'll start to grapple with the meaning on a deeper level then. Mm. Or also, you know, I'll ask some questions that will, I think, that they'll start to grapple with it. I'll say, well, how do you think that affected you in the future that this had happened? Do you think that affected you later? And they'll start to think about it, and maybe, and a lot of times they'll say, these are questions I've never thought about before.
Yeah.
How did that affect the way you were with your own children?
Mm.
You know, I never thought about that before, but, you know, that is something that, and so they'll start to grapple with the meaning of that. And another thing is that we had interviewed a couple people as they were dying, and they did comment, and the two that really hit me the hardest were the youngest, the two women who both died at age 40. And I think what they realized by telling their story is that they had lived rich lives. Because I think before they started to reflect in their lives, all they could reflect on is, I'm dying and I'm not even 40 and I'm leaving my young children. But when they told their story, they realized they'd lived eventful, rich lives. And it gave them a solace that they hadn't had before, their families told me afterwards.
And for the two women that Susan was just mentioning, there's also the solace in the formal process of creating a legacy for the children. Because the children are not just going to have pictures of their deceased mother on the mantle. They also will have her voice for the rest of their lives.
Right.
Oftentimes in those situations, we'll get to the end of the book, and then we'll ask them, what words of wisdom do you want to pass on? Or what do you think is most important? Let's kind of delineate for the people who love you what you feel in your heart is most important. And so many of the projects that we've done, when we get to those pages at the end of the book, even though I've been intimately familiar with it, if I read them afresh, I'll get tears in my eyes because they're meaningful.
Are there some themes or some commonalities that you've seen in those final pages?
You know, it's interesting. It's not as universal as you'd think. People do have very different takes on what it takes, what you can do to lead a satisfying life. So, you know, it really is individual.
Yeah.
And then some people have a lot of advice to give, and other people say, I really don't have advice to give because I think each person has to decide for themselves how to live their life. And I couldn't even imagine telling anybody how to live a satisfying life themselves. But other people really have a lot of, you know, lessons they want to pass on that they've gleaned from their own lives.
Yeah. Do you feel, are most of the people who you're working with close to dying? And I ask because is death like present on the mind when you're creating this? Because I don't know because I have never written a memoir, whether people write memoirs purely for legacy purposes, but it seems like so foundational in the work that you do is the idea that, like, this is what I'm going to pass on when I die.
Well, certainly the two young clients that we're talking about knew they were going to die soon. So that's why, otherwise, I don't think most people in their 40s would say, okay, I'm going to stop, and I've got young children, and I've got a career, and I've got all this going on, but I'm going to take the time to write my memoir, unless they had a particular story that they thought should be out there right now, and they were professional writers. But most people don't take the time to do that if they're not a professional writer in their 40s. The other people, a lot of them live a long time after they do their personal history, but usually either they or their adult children are aware that they're sharp now, they're able to recall their story and tell their story with a lively voice. Mm-hmm. And so now's the time to do it because we don't know what the future holds. Mm-hmm. And I've had several clients say to me, and one in particular said, he said to me, "Wow, am I glad that I had you interview my dad when I did, because if I had waited two more years, he would not be able to have recounted the stories he did. He started to lose his cognitive abilities." Now, mm-hmm. he didn't know that. The man is still alive, but you want to sit down and capture that story when the person is really sharp. I don't know if you saw the movie They Shall Not Grow Old, the new World War I documentary mm-hmm. that Peter Jackson just released.
No, I haven't seen it.
Well, it's excellent. And he used oral histories that were done of World War I vets in England. And these were done when they were in their 60s. So the voices are very clear and lively and with it. And it makes a big difference versus when you hear interviews with veterans who are in their 80s and older. As you age, you just can't tell stories as well, and you can't recall stories as well as you can when you're younger.
Mm. Austin, I will say, though, that I think death is present always in what we do, because the majority of our projects is about legacy, and legacy implies death and loss. And many of our clients are trying to hold on to the life story before it's too late. Because you never know when it's going to be too late. So, yes.
And capture it. Capture it before it's too late. Because
right.
If they, you know, what I always tell, I do a lot of talks about the value of recording your personal history. And what I always say is there's the expression that you've probably heard, Austin, you can't take it with you, but your life story is one thing you take with you when you pass on, if you don't either have it videotaped or recorded or audio recorded or written. If you don't have it recorded somehow, you mm-hmm. take it with you. And we all have been in the experience, had the experience of somebody dying and sitting around and saying, "Yeah, she moved to Ohio in her 20s. Now, why did she move there again? I can't remember. Do you remember?" "No, I don't remember. I wish we had asked her that." Everyone thinks of questions that they wish they had asked before, when someone can answer the question. And once they're gone, you miss your chance.
So now, like, everyone's recording everything. And I feel like, you know, I was never fortunate enough to meet. I met one of my grandparents and unfortunately didn't get to meet the other three. And I'm thinking now, like, my grandchildren are going to be able to go to, like, probably, unless the technology changes, Andy, my YouTube channel and see me, my podcast and see me, like all the social media stuff that's like all out there. Everyone's being recorded all the time. So I'm wondering, from your perspective, as people who create narratives that tie people's lives together, is this constant recording that a society is doing, is that memorializing and making legacies for people?
Part of the process of formal storytelling is pruning and getting rid of all the extra stuff that shouldn't be there. A good editor is somebody who isn't afraid to cut. And I think all the time about the amount of pictures that are taken and video clips that are recorded. And at a certain point, it becomes an avalanche. In that Harry Potter scene where they're in the vault and... I can't remember the spell. I'm kind of a Harry Potter geek. it's the doubling spell.
Okay.
That is how I think of all the things that are getting recorded with the technology, the pictures, the stories, the video clips, the everything else. So why books? And what's the difference between what we do and what people of your generation are doing? One thing with books, if you sit down with your, say, grandmother's life history, what you get is a package that you can sit down and enjoy distraction free. You can read start to finish her version of her life. And I think that's different than trying to sort through thousands and thousands of video clips or pictures, if you can even have access to them. Like if you're the great grandchild, are you going to have access? We don't know at this point because the technology is still fairly new. Hmm. Probably books affect a different area of the brain than quick moving videos or even pictures. Hmm. We don't know because the technology is still fairly new. Going back to what I said at the beginning is accessibility. In 100 years, had your great-grandfather done his personal history, chances are you could walk over and pull it out in 10 seconds or less, assuming it's on the family bookshelf.
Right.
And with the clips that are in the cloud, you know, no, not the same. It's just the permanence that comes with books.
Yeah.
So they're both valuable, but I feel like one is a curated story start to finish.
Right.
And the other is an avalanche of clips.
So then I wonder if you guys had to offer some advice to, you know, maybe I'm thinking about, like, I was fortunate enough to take a class at Stanford where we tell a personal story live on stage. You know, it was somewhere around like a 7-minute story. And in choosing a moment from my life and like constructing a narrative around it, I learned a lot about myself.
What story did you choose?
So I chose a story about how, I was raised in a non-religious family. My mom is Christian, my dad's Jewish, but they didn't raise any of us children with kind of a religious identity. And so I like never thought about religion at all. And then at Stanford, I ended up joining a Bible study group in my junior year, which I was in for a couple of years. And so the story was about how that came to be, how I joined that group, why I joined that group, what I learned from joining that group. And now, like, that group, I think, in my mind, has more significance than maybe it otherwise would have if I had not created this story around it. So, Susan, maybe you can speak to the significance and maybe encourage people to reflect on their lives, the importance of reflecting on their lives, and whether it's through journaling or whatever it is, telling stories that can help crystallize those moments and give meaning to life.
Well, I do think that does happen when you reflect back. And I really think that if I were to give someone advice and they say, well, where do I begin? What do I know? And where do I start? I would say, just look at each chapter of your life. Who were the people who had the biggest impact on you, who were most important to you? And what were the experiences and events? If you just look at those three things, then the stories will emerge out of that.
Yeah.
Not worry so much about shaping the story at that time, because it's hard to tell the story, shape it, and get it just right in the first time. So I think I would just think about that, reflect that way, and journal, and then maybe go from there to try, if you really wanted to create a piece that people, that's going to be compelling and people are going to enjoy reading, maybe at that point think about, is there a better way to tell this to make it a little more compelling than the way I first put it down?
Yeah, cool. Anything to add to that, Andy?
If any of your storytelling audience wants to write their own personal history, just be yourself and let your voice come through and be honest, because that is what your readers connect with.
I'll tell people, the story should sound like you sat down on a long plane ride next to someone who's really curious, and they're asking you questions about your life, and you're just conversationally telling them about your life. It shouldn't sound like you wrote it with a capital W, because that's will turn people off, and it won't be it'll be harder to tell authentic stories if it's not in your authentic voice.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the cool things I think what you're doing is you are taking that time to transcribe, and I'm sure a lot of those transcriptions go directly into the book, where you're maintaining the the specific language
Absolutely.
That they use.
I use as much of their actual language as I possibly can. It's just, I call it that I steam press it so that it's tidy and and more compelling of a story structure. Mm-hmm. But I use much of their voice, and the highest compliment we could ever get is when someone reads one of the books we've produced and they say, I can hear my father's voice. We had a client who we finished his book, and he didn't give it to his children. He ordered quite a few copies. 7 years later, we got a phone call from his daughter-in-law. He kept it a secret and had one child know about it, and they were distributed after his death. And his daughter-in-law said, it sounds just like him. We hear his voice. So that's what we really are. That's our aim. Yeah. And our voice has no place in it whatsoever. It's always the narrator's voice.
Right.
Do you have anything to add to that?
No, I did just want to mention a few of our favorite memoirs.
Yeah, please.
We really like, of course, like everyone in America, Frank McCourt's Angela's Ashes.
Okay.
A less well-known one that we loved was Tobias Wolff's This Boy's Life.
Yes, and Stanford then, English professor.
And then Andre Agassi's memoir, Open, is exceptional.
Okay. Very cool.
And one that's mentioned off a lot and I thought was excellent, I think it's by Carolyn Knapp, and I think it's called Drinking a Love Story.
Okay.
That's really focuses on her addiction, but it was a very well told story.
Cool. And if people are curious and learning more about you, your work, where can they check you out?
We can be found at
personalhistoryproductions.com. personalhistoryproductions.com. Check it out, everybody, and think about the value of capturing the stories of your loved ones. All right. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Austin.
Yeah, thanks. That's it for episode 13 of the Austin Meyer podcast. Did you enjoy that conversation? I know that it definitely got me thinking differently about how I'm creating stories, or thinking differently about the purpose, maybe in some senses, of the stories I create. Thinking about stories as a way to leave a legacy is actually really powerful, and I hope it made you think about storytelling differently too. Thanks again to Susan and Andy for coming on the show. Thanks to Opus Orange for today's theme music, and thank you for listening. Remember to check out my latest short documentary with National Geographic. And if you're enjoying this podcast, please share it with a friend of yours who also enjoys storytelling. And lastly, if you want to ask questions for a future guest on the show, check out my new Patreon page at www.patreon.com/AustinMeyerFilms to learn more. I'm just getting it up and running. It's a membership platform where if you enjoy the work I do, you can help support it. And so I'm excited about the prospect of that and creating a really thriving community of storytellers. So check out patreon.com/AustinMeyerFilms to check that out and learn more. All right, that's it from me. Thanks so much again for joining. Now go out and tell some stories.